Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder turned investor. You know, we're going to be talking about building, scaling, financings, also turning the chapter two and exiting a founder company, going public as well. And then also there's the tons of founder learnings our guest is going to share with us today. And then also how they look at portfolio companies too, you know, when it comes to making new investments now that they're on the other side, that he's on the other side of the table. So again, inspiring conversation ahead of us. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Eugene Malobrodsky. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's exciting to be part of both of our journeys, I guess, on this podcast.
So let's do a little bit of a walk through memory lane here, Eugene. I know that you were born in Lithuania, in a small town there, and eventually you came to the U.S. at 13, but give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
So I grew up in second largest city, but in a country that's, under 2 million people, it's a small country. So I grew up in a family, both parents engineers, important, like my whole family is education first, just like many Eastern European families. And I think the inspiration was always not doing things that everybody was doing for me. And I was always eager to be entrepreneurial. And I had, to some extent, engineering mindset where I liked to build things. I liked to put things together. For me, like everything was like a puzzle piece. And at the same time, the gift that I was born with that I didn't have to learn is I was an extrovert. So it was easy for me to communicate with other people. And I think that was like a big push towards my future.
And also, I guess, coming to the U.S. too, when you were 13, I'm sure that at 13, you're already a grown up. You're very well aware of your surroundings. You know, you've already made your friendships. You are familiar, with everything around you. You are able to really use your judgment as well. So when you come here to the U.S., you move to Silicon Valley with your parents, you come to the land of opportunity. I'm sure that it was amazing for you to be able to see all of this. And I'm sure it was kind of like a culture shock too. But I guess, it was dealing with the unknown and it was like new friendships, new everything for you. And that's uncertain too when you're 13 and when you're trying to find your own identity. So how do you think that experience shaped you up as well?
Absolutely. I think that was probably, I was very excited to move to the U.S. Like as any kid that's, United States, oh my God, Disneyland, the money grows on trees kind of thing. But when I moved here, it was difficult. My English was okay, not great. So I had to learn the language. I had to make new friends, and that part, thank God, was the easy part, and mostly because of my extrovert kind of, I'm an extrovert by birth, so that helped me create new relationships, but, it's a new place, new language, new everything, but I think perseverance and grit and wanting to meet new people, learn, and surround yourself with people that care and want to grow is how I grew myself.
So then in this case, for you as well, you got involved with the world of startups pretty early on. Was it like a like an easy transition, you know, like to go into the world of startups, or how did you get into it?
Yeah, so my uncle already lived here in the United States, and he came to Lithuania and brought a laptop. We're talking about like black and white screen, like one of those big bricks. And like I really fell in love with like computers and what you could do with them. And when I moved to the United States, you know, I continued learning more about computers. I took classes in computer graphics and different things. And I got an opportunity through my mom, actually, to join the company that she was working at that time in a different department, testing more or less Iridium product, which was like the phones that you used to have on the airplanes. So the company was doing localization. The company was called Samultrans. They're still there. And I was basically hired as a QA tester to test the product. And that kind of was like the start of and actually outside my window was the first office of Google. Like I could see Google's first office that used to be actually Sun Microsystems office, but that kind of gave me an understanding that this is the path I want to take, that technology is the drive of the future. And this is how I kept going. From there, I joined another startup that did not work out as a system administrator. The company did not survive. After that, I joined another company that was in IT asset management. And I learned the art of sales. And I understood that I'm really good in selling. And I also understood that I'm just really not good at following direction and go and being like told what to do. Yes, I mean that's since childhood, but like that moment I understood that I can do this myself. And it just happened that my friend that I met still in middle school also lost his job at back then Remedy Corporation. I don't know if you remember that. And we basically took our parents' credit cards and started the business from credit cards and grew that business to over $1 million in ARR. But in the back of my mind, I always wanted to create a product company, not just like selling IT asset company. And when we were walking around first, I mean, we're talking about like early 2000s, right? So like talking about like 2002 or so. And you couldn't just go to a restaurant or coffee shop and work out of a coffee shop, because the Wi-Fi was not there, or it was extremely expensive. You had to pay like hourly. So the idea that we had is like, okay, let's build this. And when we have enough money, we'll build a company that's able to bring democracy of access to the internet to others and ourselves. So we could be on University Avenue in Palo Alto or in the streets of San Francisco and be able to work from anywhere and enjoy that without needing the office. And that opportunity came in 2005 when we decided that that was the time to build a new company that was called AnchorFree. And the whole idea at first in the company was about democracy of internet access in terms of Wi-Fi. And we created our own software. We hired our first engineers that would allow to insert advertising into the Wi-Fi stream. And while you're on the Wi-Fi, it's free. You don't have to pay for it. And it was sponsored by advertising. So through lots of different events, we got introduced to some amazing investors that, you know, it was like two 23-year-olds trying to build something. Literally have no experience in building anything significant in terms of companies.
But it was massive, you know. I mean, and I like for you to continue here because, I mean, you guys raised for this company $430 million. So, I mean, it was incredible. So walk us through how the introduction, you know, keep going on how you got introduced and then how the experience of going from one financing cycle to the next, how did that unfold as well?
That's a great great story, which has, you know, lots of sweat and tears and blood, I would say. I mean, we got introduced through some connections that we had to this banker that introduced us to Burt Roberts, who was a former CEO and chairman of MCI. And he's like, okay, I'll meet with these guys. So we fly all the way to Baltimore. Two young guys going into the office of, I think it was already like part of Verizon, but he still had an office inside the building. We go on there on like on the 20-something floor, and we meet with Bert, who literally built one of the largest telecoms in the United States. And we sit in front of him, we tell him our idea that, hey, we want to build this Wi-Fi network that will be in all the downtowns around the United States and stuff like that. He asks us questions, how we're going to monetize. We explain it through advertising and so on. So, okay, he's like, thank you very much. Let me think about it. So we leave the office. We go downstairs. There's a restaurant there. We sit down. Like, there's no freaking way that this guy is going to invest in us. Like, no freaking way. Like, then about an hour later, he calls and he's like, you know, I'll give you money to build this. And not only that, he went to a lot of his friends and brought in investors. We're talking about like DuPont family office. We're talking about a lot of the telecom guys. And that was the first time when somebody really believed in us. And he stayed as a mentor till the end with us and on our board, which we're extremely thankful for. But that was when we started. So, and as we were building out our network, we understood one thing, that the cost of infrastructure and maintenance of that infrastructure was very high. So we were thinking, is like, okay, what else can we bring as a product that people can take with them and continue generating revenue for us so we could actually be able to afford? So we created the product that became famous, which is Hotspot Shield. And the idea of Hotspot Shield was, you come to the network, you can turn on our product, it secures the connection, provides you privacy and protection against man-in-the-middle attacks and so on. And we basically, for a really long period of time, until 2000, so we started the company in 2005. In 2008, we launched Hotspot Shield. Sorry, 2007, we launched Hotspot Shield. And in 2008, this is the moment where we had no money in the bank account. And 2008, as you can remember, is the time when the whole market was collapsing. We went to a lot of VCs. Everybody basically told us no. And we struggled. And we had a board meeting with our investors. This is the first time when we had to let go a lot of people. And that was very hard. But we basically sat down with our board and they gave us a bailout round. It was a down round, but they basically said, look, this is your last lifeline. And when you, and one of the learnings, and like one of the quotes that stuck with me for such a long, that's until today, is that for every dollar that you spend, you need to make a dollar and a penny back, at least. And most of our investors were extremely conservative, not very Silicon Valley investors. They were like, okay, when you invest, when you're investing into something and spending, you need to make money. You cannot just throw money away. So in 2009, we actually broke even. In 2011, we burned all through our NOLs. And this, and one of the things in 2008, and this is one of the learnings that we had, and I would highly suggest to a lot of the founders out there to not be afraid to let go something that does not work. So we stuck to the idea that we want to build the networks and build an idea of the hotspot shield at the same time. And clearly the network aspect was not going to break even for us. It's just draining money, resources, engineering, IT, like everything, because you own the infrastructure. You're like a small telecom.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So how do you detach yourself? Because, I mean, that's saying, it sounds like you guys were attached to that strategy. So how do you guys detach?
We were attached to the strategy, but we understood that hospital was taking off. I mean, hospital was taking off, and it kind of started taking a life of its own. I mean, it became a platform of privacy and freedom, especially in countries that had internet censorship. So one of our marketing guys put an ad for Hotspot Shield on one of the blogs in Egypt. And all of a sudden, Hotspot Shield just exploded. We're talking about like adding at like 10 servers every 2 days. But we were still so married to that first one, not letting go, which was like burning a hole in our pocket, which led us to some extent to almost running out of money in 2008. Like if we would have said, okay, that stuff, that idea doesn't work, like forget about it. This thing is growing. Focus on that, forget about the other business, but we're just married. I guess it's like founder's baby, right? And you're like, do I give up one baby because I want to save the other one? Or so we were trying to save two babies. And that's that was a huge mistake, I think. But going forward, in 2013, Goldman Sachs came in and said, guys, we love your business. We love your growth. We're highly profitable. And back then we were still profitable only from advertising. And Goldman invested $55 million in us in 2000, and I believe it's 2013, which was great. Like, we had three term sheets or so. Goldman was like, take our money, no, almost no strings attached. We took the money, we started growing the business. We obviously went public, everybody found out that there is Goldman invested in this VPN company. So this is when most of the competitors came to the market. We were the first ones to create technology that used to be used for enterprises back to the consumer level. And that was one of the things that was quite amazing, because, you know, we're at the same time, it was very hard because you are basically bringing the product that did not have a market at that moment yet. So we have to teach the market what it is, why you need it, and also for people to continue using it. So then we have a lot of competitors started coming in as well, but we're still basically the leaders. I mean, we were top in the App Store globally, in the top 50, top 20 apps overall. And like number one, number two in category. In like Middle East, we were competing against number one spot was like Quran, which is insane. But we kind of became a company. It was not just a company that's generating revenue, but also creating a huge impact on the world, which is providing democracy and privacy and security to people around the world to be able to speak up their minds in different regimes.
Now, one thing obviously led to the next. And then eventually, you know, the company got acquired, you know, by the investors that bought the majority. And then, you know, they split the company into three different pieces. And this actually happened in 2020, which was actually around 2020, no, or 20, what was the year?
2018.
But regardless, you know, it was a pivotal moment for you, because at this point, you know, obviously you had been, you know, with the company for quite a bit of time. I mean, we're talking for like close to like something like
15 years.
I mean, 13 years. Like crazy amount of time.
Crazy.
And this was your identity. This is everything that you knew. So obviously this chapter, you know, it's time to turn page. And here you are reflecting on the journey, figuring out what's next. And obviously one thing that you were excited about was immigrant founders, right? I mean, you were an immigrant founder too. So how does that translate into you all of a sudden finding yourself in One Way Ventures? What was that transition like?
So I was still at Anchor Free after the new investment, and they brought in some of their new management. But I was already starting to think, like, what do I want to do next? I mean, I've been a founder for 17 years of two companies nonstop. And like, there wasn't even a gap in the middle. And I was like, okay, what do I want to do next? And I had felt the inspiration. I brought over 200 people from different countries around the world to work for me at Anchor Free. And I saw how hard they work. I understood that they're giving up so much for the better future, that I wanted to be like, okay, these are the type of people that are basically, first of all, building the country here, and also are the future. And I wanted to raise a small fund and invest in the immigrant founders. And I met a friend. I said, hey, who is a founder of PetCube? And he's like, oh, you know, I told him about the idea of starting this fund and invest in immigrant families. Like, actually, I have my angel investor, who is Simeon Dukac. He originally was the MIT Blackjack team group leader and started the company, sold the company, became angel investor in many companies, and then was managing director of Techstars in Boston before he started OneWay. And he's like, you should talk to him because it feels that you have the same vision of what you guys want to do. So he introduced me to Simeon, and we had a great conversation. He's like, look, before you start your own, this is a long journey. You should try it out and see if you even like it. So I joined him as a venture partner while I was still doing Anchor Free. And that moment at Anchor Free, I was now chief strategy officer, which is like a title without really power. So I basically started bringing in companies, investing in companies as a venture partner. And then basically when we started raising our second fund, because I joined the midway of the first fund, Simeon has asked me if I would be interested in joining as a full-time partner on the journey with him and our third partner, Lex. And I accepted. We successfully raised our $65 million fund and been investing in a first-gen immigrant founders that are building companies here in the United States, primarily. And you know what the interesting stats are? If you look, the stats today that 55% of American startups are actually built by immigrant founders. And it's even bigger percent, 80% of American unicorn companies have an immigrant founder or an executive, which is staggering. And so this is why I really believe in this. And if you just think about like how much you're giving up by moving here, you're giving up your friends, your relatives, your home that you grew up on, and you basically move all the way to a different country. You just have to grind to succeed. You just can't afford not to succeed. Otherwise, why the hell did you sacrifice all of this if you're not going to succeed?
Yeah, no, and obviously yeah, that's a big one. You know, as an immigrant myself, I can totally relate to what you're saying there. I guess you guys now have about 110 million assets under management. How many investments have you guys done so far?
So in both funds, we've done around 50 plus investments.
And then what do you look for in founders? You know, what are some of the traits?
So one, they have to be at least one of the founders needs to be a first-gen immigrant. Basically, person who immigrated to United States and not born in the United States. Number one, it's a team and the founder bet. We're looking for founders that have an idea that they truly believe in, want to change an industry. And we primarily focus on industries as fintech, health tech, logistics, deep tech, and B2B SaaS. Those are our like primary areas that we invest in. And we're really looking for founders that really want to make an impact on the industry and build something big. I know it sounds cheesy. Everybody says like, oh, I want to build something big. But this is, I think, something that every investor is looking for.
Now, in this case, you know, when you see like, obviously, like pattern recognition is a big one, you know, when people are thinking about investments, right? And thinking about engaging with founders. So what is the one thing, you know, at a personality, you know, trait, a character thing, one thing that you see perhaps, you know, repeats the most, you know, on some of those founders that end up building something big?
That's a very good question. I think resilience. And I think would be most likely survival instinct. Basically, thinking when things don't go as planned, thinking outside the box how they can survive. I think that's one of the big differentiators.
So I guess there's probably a lot of people right now listening to this that are immigrants or are thinking about coming to the U.S. I guess if they're looking to for example, like to build, you know, their relationship, to be able to connect with people like you, Eugene, what kind of like tip do you have for them? How can they go about doing so? Because obviously you land here, you don't know anyone, you don't know anything. How do you go about being able to connect with people like you?
I mean, the first thing, they can go on LinkedIn, find my name, and connect with me. Even if we don't invest, I try as hard as I can to find time to help people and give a suggestion. The other week, I helped a founder that's too early for us to invest in. I helped him with reviewing his deck, giving him ideas, and helping him redo his pitch, just because I wanted to help him. Our website, onewayvc.com, you can apply and contact us through there as well. That's the other way of contacting us. But LinkedIn is probably the easiest.
There you go. And just one last thing here, Eugene. If I could bring you back in time to the early 2000s and give you the opportunity of having a chat with that younger self, that younger Eugene that was thinking about building a company of his own, and you had the opportunity of giving your younger self one piece of advice before launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
Always try to hire the best people. Not only the ones that are great at what they do, but also true believers in what your company is building, because those are the people that will help you and the company to really, really succeed. I think that's probably like really take the time to interview the people. By the way, one thing that I didn't mention is I actually interviewed every person that we hired. And some people, I said, look, this is just not a fit. Not because he doesn't have the skills. It's just culture or just did not feel that this could be part of the family.
I mean, I hear you on that. Well, Eugene, incredible, you know, the discussion here. And I want to thank you for really taking the time to be with us today. And it has been such an honor to have you. So thank you.
Thank you so much as well.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.